Did you ever wonder exactly how financial advisors get paid? Well, I'm about to explain in this, the 11th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Thanks again for listening. I definitely appreciate it. We're going to take a little departure today from the typical retirement-specific information discussed. Today, I want to talk about how financial advisors are paid. This is a fun one. It's a little off the beaten path, like I said, not the typical sort of IRA and Medicare type stuff we usually talk about, but nonetheless interesting. And it's a question that comes up a lot. And I think it's important to break down and explain because there's a lot of misunderstanding, misinformation, and confusion out there about what exactly a financial advisor is, let alone how he or she is paid. So that's what I want to get into. So let me start by saying that part of the problem is there is no single standard definition of financial advisor, and it's the industry's fault because there's multiple different regulatory bodies that all come into play, and these regulatory bodies don't have a lot of overlap necessarily. They often don't jive and connect with one another. So there's really kind of three main broad and distinct regulatory bodies that come into play that, depending which form of regulation this person, the advisor is under, that'll dictate what he or she sells, what product or service they sell, how they're paid, the standard of care, whether or not they have to act in your best interest or not, and things like that. So for now, I'm going to use the term financial advisor generically, but just know that that term itself implies nothing. It tells you nothing about what the person does, how they're paid, who they work for. It's just simply a generic, used and often misused term, but I'm going to use it for today just to be consistent. But you'll see as I go through this, you'll get a much better understanding of the very different structures belying the financial advice industry. So the problem stems from the fact that the simple giving of financial advice isn't its own industry per se. It doesn't have its own standalone regulation. Like the giving of medical advice is overseen and governed by, the state medical boards. I'm not a doctor. I don't know the right terms, but the point is, you need a license to give any sort of medical advice to people, at least for compensation. I mean, you can get medical advice from your mother, your brother, your sister. He or she doesn't need to be licensed, but to do this as a business, to do it for compensation, you need to have, a medical license in effect. And same thing with law. You can't practice law. You can't give advice about law without being duly registered by your state's bar association. So that's the single governing body of for giving legal advice. So to say you're a doctor, a medical doctor, or to say you're a lawyer means something, and people, or at least most adults, know what's implied. It knows there's a single oversight. You know your license. You know you had to have some minimum level of schooling to be a doctor, to be a lawyer. With financial advisor, there's really no such standardization. And it's really sad, and I hope it changes, but I don't think it will in our lifetimes. So anyway, the point is, there's no standalone regulation or license to simply give advice. The giving of financial advice is in effect, just kind of indirectly bolted on or indirectly stems from one of three underlying registrations or governing bodies. First is the investment management industry, those that will pick and choose stocks, bonds, mutual funds, whatever, for you. You give them the discretion to make these investment choices for you on your behalf. These are investment managers. To be in investment management, you need to be regulated and registered nationally by the Securities and Exchange Commission, otherwise known as the SEC, or if you have less than $100 million of client assets under your management, you then get registered at the state level. Depending how many clients you have in each state, you may need to be registered in multiple states, but for the most part, you need to be registered at least in your home state of operation and any other state in which you have more than five clients in that state. You need to register that state as well. And then again, once you hit $100 million of assets under management, then typically it's you have to get registered nationally by the SEC. So that regulation has been around since 1940, I believe, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. So quite a while. But specific to the management of investments, the giving of security specific, you know, investment specific advice to people. The Investment Advisors Act of 1940 doesn't talk about general financial planning. It doesn't talk about giving guidance about budgeting and cash flows and helping you make decisions about Social Security. It's not in there. It's specific to investment management, investment advice. So that's the first one, investment managers. The second one is securities salespeople. So those that have licenses to sell securities, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, exchange traded funds, real estate investment trusts. The person that actually sells it. Now, this is different from investment managers. Investment managers don't sell you securities. They invest in securities on your behalf. You know, you give them permission to oversee your money and make investment decisions for you, but they're not directly selling you anything. When they do buy a stock or bond on your behalf, it's ultimately getting bought from some broker. That broker is technically the one selling you the security. The investment manager is just the one making the decision of what you buy or sell. So that was the first prong, first type of regulation. The second one, as I mentioned, is securities. So these are the brokers. These are the ones who actually are the ones consummating the sale or purchase of between you and some agent or broker of a stock, a bond, a mutual fund. And then these are also overseen nationally by what's called FINRA, the Financial Industry National Regulatory Association. I could have that wrong, but the acronym is FINRA, F-I-N-R-A. Again, national. So anyone who is legally able to sell securities to or from clients needs to have licenses under FINRA to sell securities. And then third is insurance, like life insurance and annuities. You cannot sell someone a life insurance product or an annuity without being registered as a life insurance salesperson. You have to have a license to sell insurance. And that's different from investment management and securities in that insurance regulation is at the state level. So you need to have your licenses in each state in which you operate. Again, whereas investment management is the SEC nationally or state level, if you're small enough, securities is always going to be national, and then insurance licenses is state by state. So if you operate in multiple states, yes, you will have registration or you will have insurance licenses across, you know, multiple, if not tens of states, but it is state specific. So those are the three broad types of underlying regulations that financial advisors may have. You can see so far, none of these three directly involve the giving of general financial advice. Investment managers are specifically to pick investment stocks, bonds, mutual funds, you know, pick investments for you on your behalf. It doesn't really make mention of broader general financial advice. License two, security salespeople, that's specifically just to consummate a sale, to sell you a security. Option three is just to consummate an insurance product sale, to sell you insurance. So where does financial advice actually fit into these? Well, like I said, it doesn't directly. They're all just sort of indirectly bolted on. So for example, investment management, along with the security investment specific advice and recommendations, you can also give broader general financial advice about things like Social Security and Medicare planning and even taxes. You don't need a license to give someone tax advice. So you can do tax management there as well. Securities, same thing. Now, with securities, they're not really technically supposed to give you guidance and advice and recommendations about investments, about securities. They can. There's an exception. So long as the investment-related advice they're giving is quote-unquote incidental to the sale of the product, to the discussion of the product at hand. So all else equal, you can't really walk into a stockbroker's office, for example, and say, hey, you know, give me recommendations of things that would be good in my portfolio. He or she can't really, unless the advice they give about those securities is incidental to their core business of selling a product. So, you know, in that case, this is kind of a really hokey example, but I don't know why it came to mind. So you walk into a stockbroker's office, you know, he or she can indirectly give you some general investment guidance, but it kind of has to be high. Insurance sales folks are allowed on the fringes, let's say, to give general investment guidance and advice, but only if it's incidental to the sale of one of their products. So you can't walk into someone who only has insurance licenses, you can't walk into his or her office and say, hey, structure for me an investment portfolio of stocks and mutual funds. They simply can't. or I mean, not to say some people won't try to, but the advice they do give needs to be incidental to their core product, to their you know, to the sale of an insurance product. So those are the three ones. And just to add, to kind of bolt on two others, there's also financial coaching. This one's a big gray area. Now, the first three I mentioned, it's really the sale of products that are involved and the giving of investment-related advice that are involved. Those things are indeed regulated, as I discussed. But broad, if all someone wants to do is give general advice, general broad money advice, like debt management, budgeting, helping you structure cash flows, things like that, you technically don't need any licenses to do it. You can't sell securities without licenses. You can't sell insurance without license. You can't talk about investments and give recommendations on investments without license or regulation. But you can give general other financial advice with zero credentials, zero regulation. So financial coaches, for example, don't need to be regulated at all. So long as they don't cross the line of talking about investments, they're fine. They don't violate anything. And so long as, you know, they can't sell you securities or insurance either. But again, the big thing is, the bright line is, do not talk about investments. They cannot give investment advice or investment recommendations. That's crossing a line they can't cross. Otherwise, if you just want someone to help you make decisions about budgeting, you can go to a quote unquote financial coach, and he or she doesn't need any regulation. And then also complete strangers, you know, crazy uncle at Thanksgiving who's got the hot stock tip for you. If they're not doing it for compensation, anyone could give you advice with zero recourse or zero issues. Even folks, famous talking heads, Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman, they are not regulated salespeople or investment managers. They can say and do whatever they want. They're no different than some random person, not a stranger, telling you what stocks you should buy. They're allowed to say whatever because they don't have regulations that restrict them from saying or doing certain things. So do they give advice? Sure. They will probably tell you they don't. They tell you they give you general recommendations, but they do seem to give very clear, pointed recommendations and advice in a lot of their shows and books and whatever. But because they're not regulated, they're free from any recourse and free from any damages if you act on something they do and it blows up in your face. Not their fault, because, you know, they don't have licenses to do this stuff, and you shouldn't view them as actual advice givers, because they're not. They're entertainers. They're financial entertainers is the best way to think about it. Confusing, I know. To help clear this up, I actually did a YouTube video, a three-part series called How to Find a Financial Advisor. And in that, there's a link in the show notes here. In that three-part series, I walk through all this stuff in more detail. So it'll make more sense about investment managers versus security salespeople versus insurance salespeople, and how the regulations work, and how to find people, how to search someone's background to see what licenses they have, whatever. But the point is, it's important to know, again, to break it down into these three broad categories, because this will drive how these people, how advisors get compensated. Again, investment managers, security salespeople, insurance salespeople. So some more terminology before I actually explain how they get paid. First is, what is the word fee only? It's thrown around a lot, often misused. It's become a marketing term, so it's kind of lost some of its punch and value, in my opinion. But fee only means, simplest way to think about it is, it's someone who is not able to get compensation for their services from anyone other than you, the client. This means they have no licenses to sell securities, no licenses to sell insurance, nor do they even work at firms where someone has licenses to sell securities or insurance, because even though they not be the one selling it to you, someone at the firm still may. So fee only comes down to meaning they are only registered as investment advisors. They do not have securities or insurance sales licenses. So this rules out every insurance company you've ever heard of, because by default, they're going to have insurance licenses. It also rules out any of the household name or any brokerage firm you ever heard of, for that matter, including the household name ones that all have radio ads and slick magazine ads and big billboards, because they're all going to have securities licenses. So not, that doesn't mean it's good or bad to be working with someone at one of those places, but technically they're not fee only, because they can be paid in multiple ways as opposed to just from you. They can also be paid from commissions from selling products or other incentives or kind of kickbacks, if you will. So that's fee only. The advisor is paid solely from the client and the client only. Next is commission only. This is the exact opposite. So someone who's only licensed is to sell life insurance, for example, that person will only get paid for consummating a sale, for selling an insurance product. They will get paid by way of a commission paid on their product. There's no like hourly charge to pay for someone to sell your insurance product. There's no investment management fee to pay for someone to sell your insurance product. It's commission only. So that's the insurance example. Also, there's some securities, some mutual funds, security salespeople who do get paid a commission for selling you certain products. So some mutual funds, it's rare. At this point, 20 years ago, most mutual funds had commissions associated with them. Now, most don't. And I don't really see a lot of good reason why they should, though that there's still some, there are still some that exist. So some mutual funds will have a commission up front, otherwise known as a load. And let's just say it's 5%. What that means is you put in $100 to buy this fund, 5% gets shaved off the top, or $5 gets shaved off the top, paid as a commission to the person who sold it, and only $95 of your $100 actually goes to get investing into the fund. So that's another form of compensation, is commission only. And the third is fee-based, what's called fee-based, not to be confused with fee-only. A lot of people bastardize and do confuse these, but fee-based is a combination of the two I just mentioned. Fee-based means it's fee-only and commission. I guess it's not technically fee-only if they have commissions, but fee-based means that they can get fees directly from you, the client, plus they can also earn commissions or kickbacks from products sold to you. So that's fee-based. So that's the three forms of compensation: fee-only, commission-only, and then fee-based, which is a combination of fees from the client and commission. All right, so let's now get into how they actually get paid. Start with fee-only. So fee-only, as I mentioned, the advisor gets paid solely from the client, no one else. There's a few ways this can be done. Most commonly is fee-only are people who, let's just say, manage investments and charge you a percent of your assets as a fee. Now, the terminology fee-only sounds a little misleading, because I think most people, when they hear the term fee-only, they think it's like a fixed, I'm paying you $500 only, or I'm paying you by the hour. No, people who manage investments and charge a percent of assets, that is fee-only, so long as they don't have other securities or insurance sales licenses. So quick example of fee-only: someone manages investments, you have $1 million with them, and they charge you 1% of assets under management. That means that they're going to charge you $10,000 for the year. Now, how that actually gets paid is that $10,000 will get, in almost all cases, will get deducted directly out of your investment accounts under that advisor's management. And typically, it's broken up quarterly. So in this example, if the annual fee ends up being $10,000, again, that's 1% of $1 million portfolio. Typically, it'll be broken up and they'll take out $2,500 per quarter out of the account, so that over the course of the year, it's $10,000. And those that do charge as a percent of assets under management, which is quite common, as your asset size fluctuates, the fee fluctuates. So the next year, if your assets go up to, pick easy numbers here, $1.5 million because you deposit more money in, well, then now the fee is going to be $15,000 a year, because 1% of $1.5 million is $15,000. And then vice versa, if your account drops to $500,000 because you take money out or the market tanks or whatever, well, then 1% of that is going to be $5,000. So now your fee is $5,000 for the year. Some advisors that charge percent of assets under management do have what's called tiers or breakpoints. So it's not always just a flat 1%. 1% is typically the standard, but could be more, could be less. And what commonly happens is if you have a small amount of assets, they'll charge you more than 1%. And as your asset size increases, the percentage will kind of ratchet down to 0.8, to 0.7, to 0.6, to 0.5, to whatever it may be. So that's one part of fee only, is the assets under management charge. The other part, which is kind of, I don't want to say trending, but gaining popularity, and for good reasons, is not to have to manage investments and to have the fee paid elsewhere, in other ways, I should say. So for example, what if you hire someone, you just want some one-time advice, you don't want to hand over your portfolio, you don't want or need ongoing investment management, you just want to hire someone for 10 hours, let's say, to give you a one-time financial plan or to answer some specific questions. Well, there are advisors who just do a simple hourly charge, and hourly fees could be a few hundred bucks an hour. And you can pay that fee by check, by cash, by credit card. Oftentimes, they have a way where you can pay by bank ACH transfer, things like that. So that's also fee only. You pay directly. In that case, it's more easy to see because you're actually writing the check. You're actually making the credit card charge. Whereas the other form of fee only, the assets under management, you don't directly see it. Nonetheless, you're paying. Be very clear, you are paying this money, but it just comes out of your investment accounts, every quarter typically. So that's fee only. Commission. you don't, in many cases, you don't directly pay the commission. A good example is life insurance. And this will often be touted by those who sell life insurance that you don't pay me anything. The company whose product I sell pays me. That's true on the surface, but that doesn't mean that you're not indirectly covering that cost. So a lot of insurance sales, the commission will be paid. Again, not out of your pocket. You put $100,000 into whatever contract or policy. All $100,000 goes into the policy. The insurance company pays the commission to the insurance to the agent who sold it. But as I mentioned, that's not free to you. You're ultimately paying. Part of the way you're paying is a lot of insurance products have what's called a surrender period, meaning if you don't keep all or at least a large portion of the money in the contract or the product for at least a certain amount of years, they will charge you a surrender penalty if you take the money out early. And that surrender penalty is usually steepest early on. And the longer you stay in the contract or product, the percentage surrender penalty decreases to eventually it stops. So maybe there's a 5-year surrender or a 10-year or 12-year. You know, after the end of that period, there's no longer early surrender penalties. And a large reason for those surrender penalties is to, in effect, reimburse the insurance company for the commission it paid to the salesperson if you pull the ripcord and bail out of that contract early. So the insurance companies, is no surprise, they make money by you being in the contract because they, in effect, ultimately pay you less in the contract than what they earn on the money you gave to them, which is fine. And that's how insurance companies make money, and they should. They need to be profitable. But if you don't stay in that contract long enough, the insurance company will not have earned enough money off of you to basically cover the cost of the upfront commission they paid to the salesperson. So if you jump out of this contract in year one, they're going to hit you with a potentially large surrender penalty. And that penalty is largely to have the insurance company recoup the commission it paid. So the longer you stay in the contract, the smaller the surrender charge is, because the insurance company will have incrementally made, you know, that much more money off of you, and therefore it will have covered that much more of the upfront commission that was typically upfront commission that would have been paid to the person who sold it. So you are indirectly paying for that commission, and in other ways as well. So as I mentioned before, the way insurance companies make money is, you know, you hand over $100,000 and they promise to give you whatever over the lifetime or over the next X amount of years. They make more on the money you give them than what they pay you on it. They make a spread. So all else equal, if there wasn't a commission associated with the product sale, that spread could be smaller, meaning you can get more economics out of that product if there wasn't a commission that needed to be paid over the life of the contract. And with mutual funds, as I mentioned before, maybe you do actually pay the commission, albeit not directly. Like the example I gave, you put $100 into a mutual fund that has a 5% upfront commission. Well, $5 gets shaved right off the top, such that only $95 actually gets invested. So you in effect paid the $5 for commission. So that's how commissions actually get paid. And then fee-based, just a combination of the two. So fee-based, there are a lot of firms out there that do manage investments. So therefore, they do deduct fees as a percent of assets under management. And they may also sell products for commission, whether it's insurance or certain mutual funds or other securities that have a commission with it. So fee-based can get their fees in both ways, directly from you and indirectly through ways of through commissions. So that's how financial advisors actually get paid, which now you may be asking, what's best? What form of compensation is best? Well, it really depends. It depends what product or service you want or need. For example, if all you need is to buy yourself some term life insurance, well, you have to go find a life insurance agent. There's no way around it. You don't need a full-fledged financial planner. You don't need someone to manage investments necessarily. If all you want is, you know you want to buy $1 million of term life insurance, you need an insurance salesperson. And that salesperson will be paid a commission on the consummation of that sale. So you don't really have a choice. You may not like the idea of commission, but it is what it is in that case. There's no other way around it. Insurance products in the U.S. cannot be sold without commission. I don't believe there's any insurance products where there's not a commission associated with it. Someone has to receive a commission, at least in the U.S. Other countries may be different, but I don't think that's the case here. So in that case, the commission model is best. If all you need is to buy some basic life insurance, you will be paying a commission. That's the only option. So on the other hand, if all you want is some one-time advice about investments or about a general financial plan, or you have some other specific pointed questions, financial questions you want some help with, you're going to want fee only. You don't want to go to someone who's commission only because he or she isn't going to have a way to charge you just for advice. There is no advice only. almost without doubt, that person is going, yeah, they may give you some general advice. They'll say it's free, but at the end of it, almost certainly one of the recommendations is going to be to buy a product that they happen to sell. Because that's how they get paid, and you can't knock them for that. If the only way you get compensated is for selling product XYZ, well, then guess what? You know, you're not going to give away advice for free. It's going to be tied to the ultimately trying to sell a product. So if you just need some one-time pointed advice, specific questions, a one-time general financial plan, stay away from someone who's insurance only or security sales only. You're going to want a fee-only person where you can maybe pay hourly. Maybe they have a pre-packaged kind of one-time financial plan offering where it's not charged by the hour. It's just, you know, it's a fixed set fee that you know going into it what it's going to be. And this is why the industry is so twisted and why I dislike it so much is it's so hard to find someone who is a fit for what you're looking for, who offers a product or services you're looking for, because there isn't standardization or regulation of titles. Like I said, the word financial advisor means absolutely nothing. I've seen some real creative and real misleading names people give themselves. For example, tax exempt wealth specialist and safe money retirement specialist. Sounds awesome, right? Well, these are just folks that all they do is sell insurance. They don't have securities licenses. They don't have investment advisory licenses. All they do is sell cash value life insurance. You would never know that. You know, you look at their LinkedIn profile, you look at their websites, you look at their titles. Wow, tax exempt wealth specialist, safe money retirement specialist. Sounds good. Sign me up. No, yes, they may give you some advice, some guidance, may do a financial plan, but all signs, all recommendations are going to point to here, buy this cash value life insurance product, which coincidentally, maybe that is what you need. So that doesn't mean it's bad, but it's real misleading when you don't really know what you're looking for. You think you're wanting or needing general financial guidance, and you go to someone whose answers are all going to be, pointing you towards buying life insurance. Which again, maybe it works out, maybe it is what's best for you. But when all you have is a hammer, you tend to make every problem look like a nail, which isn't the right way to approach things, in my opinion. Now, no model is free from conflict. So to be fair, I don't think you know this, you know, those of you who know me from Facebook and YouTube, I don't agree with a lot of the way insurance is sold and some securities as well. But no model is conflict free. I genuinely feel commission only is definitely the most inherently conflicted. And I don't know how someone could try to argue it's not. But even others like fee only, percent of assets under management, for example, also clearly has its own conflicts built in. When your revenue, when your compensation is based directly on the size of assets under your management, that could very well skew your decision of, you know, should some of this money be taken out to pay down my mortgage? Should some of this money be taken out, you know, peel off a few $100,000 to maybe buy an annuity to get a guaranteed lifetime stream of income? That's going to directly impact the revenue of the advisor if he or she's compensated only as a percentage of your assets. Now, such conflicts need to be disclosed, should be disclosed. If your advisor is a percent of assets under management advisor, that conversation should be had. If not, make sure you ask, what are your conflicts of interest and how do you address it and things like that, and get them to put in writing, will you always give advice that's in my best interest at all times? That's important. Things like that. And then even hourly and flat fees have their conflicts as well. If someone charges hourly, what's to say they're not just sitting back and kind of running the clock on you, you know, charging for more time than they're actually spending. And flat fees as well. If someone charges you a flat $10,000 a year to do work for you, they may not be incentivized to actually do a lot of work because they're going to get the 10 grand regardless. So they can kind of sit back with the feet up on their desk and just sort of milk it. So now, I'm not saying this to bash those in the financial advice industry. Don't get me wrong. There are bad apples. There's bad apples in all walks of life. Financial services is no different. But there are genuinely a lot of great intentioned people who truly want to do best by their clients, regardless what product they sell, what service they do, what regulatory body they're under. There are folks who genuinely do right by clients. But without having standardization of title and having to dig through how they're actually paid, and pay definitely does influence people to at least some extent, you can't convince me it doesn't. It's really hard to know who's sitting across from the table from you and you know how interests are aligned or not. So anyway, food for thought. And finally, before I wrap up here, I just want to kind of put some numbers around things. How much do these fees actually typically cost? Well, in the fee only world, if you're looking at hourly advice, and there's not a lot of standardization. This really depends on a lot of things: the area of the country the person's in, how experienced or how much knowledge or expertise the person has, and even things like how, I don't want to say how desperate they are for business, but someone who just started out, who's trying to start a business from scratch, is probably going to undercharge just because they're anxious and, I don't want to say desperate, but wanting to get clients in the door. Whereas people who are well established and can be more choosy with who they work with, chances are they're going to charge more. Common sense. But typically, I would say those that charge pure hourly for financial advice, fee only folks, figure anywhere from $200 to $400. Not to say there won't be people who charge less or people who charge more. Those will be the extremes. But $200 to $400 per hour is probably reasonable. If you're looking for a one-time comprehensive plan, this really all depends how complex your situation is, what you're looking for, and again, the background of the advisor, where he or she's located, how much experience they have. But for a basic plan about individual finances, retirement plan, or whatever, college savings plan, you want to wrap together a whole comprehensive kit and caboodle, take a review of all your finances. Figure $2,000 at a minimum, maybe up to like $10,000 or so. But again, it depends. I know of someone who does plans for $950, and you get what you pay for. He ran me through the process. I was not impressed. Basically sits down, types some numbers in software, spits it out 2 hours later, and there's your plan, $950. I don't think that's worth it. And then on the other end, there are folks who charge tens of thousands of dollars for a plan. I know a place who works with business owners and people who have pretty complicated and hairy financial profiles where, yeah, it should be more than $10,000 because there's a lot of time and expertise and research and digging that goes into it. But for the average individual, looking to get, let's keep this focused on retirement, looking to get like a comprehensive retirement plan. When can I retire? Do I have enough now? What should I do? What do I do about my pension, my social security? Is my insurance good? Do I keep my house? Do I pay it down? Whatever, typical things. Should I do Roth conversions? Figure less than 2,000 be way too cheap. More than 10,000 is probably a lot more than it needs to be. I'm going to guess 5 to 8 probably the sweet spot for a good comprehensive plan from someone who's well qualified. And then if it's managing assets, and some advisors even wrap in financial planning with management of investments. But typically, as I mentioned before, the percent of asset under management structure is usually about 1%. It could be more, it could be less, and there often is scaling and tiering and breakpoints and things. This is kind of new. Those that do manage investments and provide planning and wrap it all into a single flat fee, a fee that is not tied to asset size. There's not a lot of folks out there that do this, but from what I've seen so far, from the limited number of people out there that do, it's $5,000 to maybe $15,000 a year, where figure upwards of 10 is probably common, but again, this is fairly new, this flat fee structure that includes investment management. So to be seen how this shakes out. As far as commissions, just so you know, with annuities, it all depends how complex, how many bells and whistles, aka riders, there are in the product. Basic, simple, vanilla annuity, couple percent maybe, give or take. And the more complicated, the more features there are, it could be upwards of 10% commission. So if you let's assume it's one of these variable annuities with lots of riders and guarantees wrapped around it, yeah, it could be upwards of 10%. So you put $200,000 into this annuity, person who sold it is going to get a $20,000 commission up front. The way life insurance works, the commission paid on life insurance is typically about equal to the first year's premium. So if you buy a term policy, it has $1,000 a year premium, the commission paid on that would be about $1,000. If you buy a cash value policy, this is a little different. Similarly, it's typically about equal to the first year's premium, but it's mostly, if not always, just based on the actual cost of insurance. So if you're getting a cash value policy and intentionally pumping a lot of extra cash into it above and beyond the cost of the actual underlying insurance, I don't believe that the commission is keyed off of the premium that goes towards the cash value. It's really just keyed off of the premium that goes to the actual cost of the product, which still isn't necessarily going to be cheap. But point is, just because you're pumping a lot of money into a cash value policy doesn't mean the commission of the person who sold it is going to be that much larger. It's still typically capped at just the underlying actual cost of the policy, which again, about the first year's cost of the policy is generally what the commission is on that. So that's that. talked a lot. Again, I know this is a little off the beaten path from what we typically discuss. I hope you found it refreshing and informative, nothing else. Definitely check out the link to the video, How to Find a Financial Advisor. That will have much more info about this and with nice graphs and things. So it's all a little more easy to digest than me just sitting here talking about it. So that's that. Again, if you like this podcast, please definitely like, subscribe, leave a nice, healthy, glowing review on whatever podcast platform you use, be it Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, whatever. It'd be greatly, greatly appreciated if you do that. And if you do like the stuff discussed in this show, definitely check out my Facebook group, Taxes and Retirement, YouTube channel, Retirement Planning Demystified, and my newsletter, Retirement Planning Insights. You can find links to all three of these in the show notes of this episode. That's it. Take care. I will see you next week.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.